Welcome to Films Fatal to the Flesh.
Films Fatal to the Flesh seeks to examine the philosophical and psychological significance of mythology in esoteric film.
We have no formal education in film or filmmaking. Our intention is to learn as much as we can from this experience and bring to light the films that we feel are meaningful. These are our top 10 favorite films of 2017.
Welcome.
Good evening, Gil.
Good evening.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
Excellent. We're enjoying some champagne here.
That's right.
It's a Saturday night.
Having
a great time. We're listening to some Alice in Chains.
Fantastic stuff.
Yes.
Unplugged, to be specific.
Right. And we're going to do a little special thing today. We are going to reveal our top 10 movies for 2017. And so we're just gonna hit the list on the way down here. So let's see, what do we have?
What are you writing down?
So just gotta be clear, I specifically didn't watch all the top listed movies of 2017. So there's gonna be some that aren't in the list that probably should be in the list, but just didn't get around to seeing them. So I don't know. Any of you out there thinking of, like, why didn't we put this specific film in the list? You know, probably just didn't see it.
Yeah, and I gotta say, like, a lot of the things on my list aren't gonna shock you if you know my taste. But I mean, I did try to see as many films of 2017 as I could, but I mean, there's only so many hours in a day.
Yeah.
And so I kind of had to go with the ones that kind of stood out to me or spoke to me in my particular. Yeah, so not, you know.
Well, and the main ones aren't even out yet. I mean, or they're in the theaters, but just haven't got a chance to go to the movies, you know, so.
Yeah, definitely. So, we'll start off here. I'm going to start off with my number 10.
Number 10.
Which is The Beguiled.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Good which, stuff. Actually, you were the one that sent me the link for that one.
Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah.
Apparently, and I could be wrong about this because I just heard it from someone saying it, but apparently this was like a remake of a Clint Eastwood film.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And I'm kind of wondering how all of that kind of like, because it's basically about like underage girls liking Colin Farrell, right?
So was Clint Eastwood Colin Farrell's character?
That's what I'm wondering.
Or was it like a completely different like reimagining, I guess?
I'm curious about that. It's too bad we don't have a Jamie, so we could tell him to pull it up.
Yeah, no Jamie here.
Yeah. But yeah, eventually. So yeah, Beguiled, it was a entertaining film. So I'll say, like, it hit 10. You know, in a top 10 list, you kind of expect it's like, these movies are fucking so badass. But it's like, yeah, if I had the chance to see 300 fucking films,
right, exactly.
My top 10 is going to be just spectacular. But it's like, The Beguiled, like, it's a good movie. It's not, like, super fantastic or anything, but it was an interesting watch, and definitely, it's definitely worth it. Like, I wasn't bored or anything.
No, it's
kind
of
And I'm easily bored by movies.
Yeah, and it's kind of a slow burn, but it's a beautifully shot film, beautiful actresses. Being that it's a period piece, they did really well with manifesting that.
Yeah.
It looks legit.
Yeah, it keeps your interest. It's not boring or anything.
Nicole Kidman, Kirsten Dunst, Colin Farrell, of course, and I can't remember the young actress's name, but I guess it doesn't matter.
Wasn't it a Fanning?
Yes, it is a Fanning.
Oh, it was a Fanning. I think I picked her as my top in the film.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Her or Nicole Kidman, one or the other.
Yeah, I love Nicole Kidman, but there's something about Kirsten Dunst.
Oh, no. She's I gotta say, man, she's kind of looking a little not that great these days.
No, but I mean, what about Nicole Kidman, you know?
Oh, I think she
looking
looks
a little stretched out.
I think she looks perfect.
She used to be, like, to me, you know, number one. She's gorgeous.
Yeah,
like,
eyes wide shut.
Eyes wide shut, exactly. Yeah. It's like, wow. But now, I don't know, she's looking a little weird.
Yeah, nah, because when I see Kirsten Dunst, I'm like, god damn.
It's more of just her, like a... I mean, she's stuck with me ever since Interview with the Vampire. You know,
yeah, and that's what everyone knows her from.
Fucking amazing. And all of her performances since then are really great. I don't really dig some movies, but overall, there's just something about her.
See, the thing is, like, what turned her into sort of this sex icon or whatever. I don't think she is that, but there was this thing after Interview with a Vampire where everyone was nuts for Kirsten Dunst, and it's like
she's
like 10 years old in the fucking film, and it's like, all right, well, shit, that tells you something.
Yeah, I guess.
All right, so let's hear your 10. Number 10.
Ooh, Transfiguration.
Transfiguration?
Yeah. I would say that it's a coming-of-age story. It's about this young man who lives, I would say, in a run-down, dilapidated city. And he befriends a girl of his age, but of a different background, I guess you could say. He has gone through some life changes that have put him and his brother in a not so good of a situation. They're kind of growing up together, you know, and it's considered a horror film, but I think it goes deeper than a horror film. It's I think it's more like drama, you know. I mean, there's a definite horror aspect to it, which I don't want to give it away because it's one of the most interesting parts of the film. But
how have I never heard of this? Or did you tell me about it? Or
yeah, probably when I watched it. Like,
you didn't tell me about it. I think you might have sent me a text about it.
Yeah, I was probably like, hey, man, check it out. But yeah, it's definitely worth the watch. It's just one of those films that you can't give away too much because the most surprising aspect of the story is all there is to really talk about.
All right. Cool. Well, did you want to tell us your number 9 now?
Number 9. The Disaster Artist.
The Disaster Artist.
Okay. Yeah. James Franco, Dave Franco. It's a kind of like a, not a mockumentary, but a documentary in the form of a film off of the film The Room.
Right.
And it's just a really fun movie. James Franco is fantastic. Probably one of his best performances ever. It's going to be one of those films where it's just so quotable. You know, like almost every line in this film is something like you can quote. It's just
You sure those aren't directly lifted from The Room and kind of integrated into the script somehow to like
yeah, it's both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the whole "Oh hi, Mark" kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's that whole aspect of it, but there's also the other things, you know, like the stuff that wasn't on the film or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean Tommy Wiseau is a really interesting character. Definitely worth a film more. And I definitely want to see it. It's definitely on my list.
The Disaster Artist or The Room?
The Disaster Artist.
Yeah.
Well, I want to see The Room fully because I've only seen like half of it. I didn't really like get invested in it. I think it's kind of one of those things where you have to put it on with your buddies.
Yeah.
And kind of laugh
at it. Seems like that. It's a quote-unquote cult film.
Because like, I kind of don't... It's kind of hard for me to watch like movies that are sort of supposed to be funny. I'm talking about The Room. That are supposed to be like sort of funny. It's kind of hard for me like just to get that on my own. Kind of, you know. Okay, so mine is actually number 9 is Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Oh, jeez.
By S. Craig Zahler or Zahler. I don't know how to pronounce it. Fuck. What?
I don't know, man.
What's wrong? Did you watch it?
No.
Well, what's the problem?
I don't know. Go on.
Okay, so this is the director of Bone Tomahawk, I'm sure you know.
Ah, I love that movie.
Yeah.
That movie's so good.
Yeah, it's very good. And one thing that it really pains me is I hear so much talk about this director. So fucking much talk about Bone Tomahawk, Brawl in Cell Block 99. Never once do I hear people mentioning how, like, odd the dialogue is. It's almost written like a sort of Marx Brothers kind of play on words, kind of Shakespearean even. It's like a neo kind of Shakespeare, fucking Mark Twain. It's like very, like every single fucking line is this weird little, like kind of a joke or kind of like a pun, you know? And it's, no one speaks as a natural, like how natural people speak.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in the movies, they all have this weird poetic kind of speak to them. I don't know if you've caught that from Bone Tomahawk.
No, man.
But the entire fucking movie is like the Shakespearean. Every fucking line is a. It's like a joke, kind of like, you know.
It's a line.
Or a figure of speech.
A delivery. Kind
of flipped.
I see.
Or it's just a weird play on words. Like the entire script of both films is like that.
So what is it about this film that got it into your top 10?
I mean, I really can't explain it, but it's sort of like kind of like this over-the-top kind of crime exploitation film. Very reminiscent of, like, you know, old exploitation films, you know, from the 70s.
I heard from somebody who I really respect that the whole movie is shit until, like, the last 10 minutes.
Well, here's the thing. Anybody that's not informed, and I'm not saying your friend isn't informed or whatever, but
yeah.
Anybody that doesn't understand that they're coming into this film knowing that the dialogue is this weird shit and it's not going to be an orthodox film whatsoever. It's like, it follows like a traditional narrative, but like I'm saying, the dialogue is so over the top in this sort of like odd way of speech kind of thing.
So it's not a genuine prison talk?
Yeah, it's not. A normal person's not going to go into it and be like, oh, this is you know, realistic and this is how people talk. They'll be like, oh, this is way too over the top, or this is really weird, or whatever, you know?
Which, since this movie is set around prison, I highly recommend anybody listening out there to check out the Ear Hustle podcast. It's an in-depth podcast about life inside prison. And one of the podcasters is actually incarcerated for life right now. So it's just a fascinating, fascinating podcast.
How do they do it, though?
Well, the woman who runs the podcast, I guess, is a volunteer at San Quentin. And so she goes down there, I don't know how often, and gets together with this guy, and they record a podcast.
Wow. Yeah. And what do they use? A Zoom or something?
I have no idea. I mean, they have like an actual audio studio.
Oh, so, they do?
Yeah,
in the prison?
In the prison, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So like prisoners can go in and make music and stuff?
Yeah, they go in and they could do interviews there. They also take a mic out into the yard and shit and interview prisoners about whatever topic the discussion is. But I mean, it ranges everywhere from like cellmates to keeping animals to food. The topics are like wide ranging. It's not anything that you would think, which is really cool.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I'm not usually into like prison content, but it does sound interesting. I definitely want to check it out.
Yeah, good. Anyways.
Okay, so number 8 on my list is Ridley Scott's Alien Covenant, which, you know,
that's totally you.
That's a pretty like big film. I was kind of disappointed. The whole reason I like Alien is kind of, and you know, okay, I like Aliens too, don't get me wrong, it's great, and I just find it absolutely fucking insane when these actual film critic type of people say that they like Aliens better than Alien.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's something I thought when I was 10, because there's a billion aliens in Aliens and there's only one alien and it's fucking boring Alien.
And that's, you know,
now though that I'm older, I realize that Alien is a fucking cinematic masterpiece, and the reason why I like it is because of this mysterious, like, xenomorph creature.
Yeah, well, I think it's because in Aliens, you know, she gets into that giant mechanical thing and fights the alien, and it's just like a whole lot of
action. I mean, it's good, and I love it. It's fine.
But Alien is definitely better.
But it does seem like kind of a movie, I wouldn't say for kids, but just for the less, you know, we'll say passive watchers of film. You know, there's active watchers of film and passive watchers of film. There's like people that are looking for the art in it, and there's some people that are just looking to get off on like a visual experience.
Yeah, there was definitely some really good, narratives to it, but it to me was kind of like disoriented, I guess, you know, like there was a certain narrative that I wish they would have stuck more with instead of building these different narratives, because it's almost like a Genesis story and you really want to know the specifics of how all this came about. But yeah, it was pretty good.
I think that's why also I have a problem a hard time with, like, Blade Runner and stuff is because it's just... it's a little too much. I like a simple story, you know? When things get a little bit too convoluted, I kind of get lost. Kind of stare at the wall and shit. Mm. I don't know. I hate to use the phrase ADD, but you know what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
You just have a kind of a problem with, like, paying attention to shit. And I have that. I have a huge problem with films, which is kind of weird because I'm doing a film podcast. But it's hard for me to pay attention.
But at the same time, I think it's also really nice because the films that matter to you are really good because they have the ability to keep your attention.
Right. And I thought Alien Covenant was good. It was. It might even be great. It might even be my second favorite of the Alien franchise. Could be. I did like Prometheus, though. So I think I might even may have liked Prometheus better.
I don't remember much Prometheus, but...
it's tough. It's super convoluted, too, and it's hard to pay attention, and it's hard to remember. But I know that at one time, I was in the perfect frame of mind. I sat down, and I fucking watched it, and I really liked Prometheus.
I gotta rewatch it.
Yeah.
And then watch Covenant afterwards.
And there's also so much, like, Ridley Scott's mythology going on in there. That it's, like, super interesting. If you were to actually sit down and pay attention to it, I'm sure there's really something redeemable there.
Yeah, no, I definitely think there is. And that's why I think that whole Genesis story is something that I wish that I would have liked to see more of.
Yeah.
Because I think that whole mythology is really thick.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So my number 8 is Dunkirk.
Dunkirk.
Yeah.
I haven't fucking seen it yet.
World War II has Cillian Murphy in it, which I got to say... I'll watch anything with Cillian Murphy, and almost everything that he's in is absolutely perfect. Also has Tom Hardy. But yeah, World War II flick. A little bit different in that you're, I guess, automatically expecting some sort of, kind of like Saving Private Ryan, you know, but it doesn't quite hit that mark. It's more of like a, just how meaningless war can be. And it just, the pointlessness of it all. And what's really interesting, though, is that you know, there are certain people in the film who you expect to be heroes that are not heroes at all. And others that you would never expect to become heroes are true heroes. So it's a really interesting dichotomy there.
See, I kind of feel like I dropped the ball there because I definitely wanted to see Dunkirk. It was a little bit hard to pull the trigger on. Even though I do love Christopher Nolan, I did hear a lot about how it's sort of not... definitely not a traditional, like, film. It's definitely not in... or is that incorrect?
No, I would agree.
You agree? It's because yeah. I heard it was more of an experience.
It like is.
A sort of...
yeah.
Because you look at something like The Prestige, and that's just, like, a masterful...
oh, man, beautiful.
Oh, dude. The Prestige, that's definitely my favorite Christopher Nolan. I know you like The Dark Knight better, right?
Yeah,
Dark Knight. You like The Dark Knight better than Prestige.
Yeah, the Joker's fucking phenomenal.
I know.
Or Heath Ledger is phenomenal, I should say.
I know, but the fucking Prestige, though, dude. Think about it. Like, think about The Prestige. Like, how fucking perfect it is and how, like, just how brutal it ends up being. Like, you don't know that it's this brutal of a film. And then it gets to the end and you're like, oh, okay. Fucking shit. You're, like, passing some real...
like, I guess so.
Dude, it, like... at the end of the film, you figure out that it's just this gigantic fucking story that
yeah.
you don't even know was going on.
I agree.
No, and that's just like, holy shit. To me, fuck.
You convinced me. Yeah, because The Dark Knight, you know, the third act kind of falls apart. You know, it's not quite what you wish it could be, you know, but The Prestige, yeah. That reveal at the end is just like fucking mind-blowing.
Several reveals at the end.
Yeah, several.
Many, many different twists. And it's not... and that's the thing, like, I love simplified stories, but if you can hit me with a convoluted story and make it all come together and make sense to me and move me, then I'm sold. So it's not like I hate complicated films, but it's just like, if you can sell the information to me in a way that moves me, then I'm not going to get lost in the convoluted story. I'm going to be paying attention.
Right,
you and know, it's gonna captivate me.
And it does that because that film made me hate Hugh Jackman.
Did it?
Dude is such a fucking prick. Yeah, and
oh,
not,
he is a dick.
And not personally, you know, but in the movie, he does such a good job at portraying his character that you just dislike him, and you dislike him in every movie he's in. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't until Chappie where I was like, all right, I can get back to watching this guy again. And then we have The Fountain.
My Hugh Jackman, what broke my Hugh Jackman cherry was fucking Prisoners.
But he's a prick in that one too.
Well, sort of.
And he's a prick in The Fountain also.
So it's just sort something of that, weird. It's sort of that anti-hero. So it's like, yeah, he has good intentions. He has great intentions. It's kind of, that's what makes it so interesting, is the morality struggle of the character, and you feel his like anguish that he has to do these immoral things.
Right.
But he thinks that he's working towards a goal. I don't want to give that away, because that's just a mindfuck of a film.
Well, and I guess to clarify, what I mean is like his acting power wasn't revealed to me until The Fountain.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, man, this dude, no wonder why he can make you hate him, because he's an excellent actor.
Yeah, see, I didn't like him because I didn't think that he should have been Wolverine.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you just kind of automatically think of him as Wolverine, and you're just like, fuck this guy. You know?
And that's stupid, because what does it matter to me? Like, I mean, okay, right, yeah, yeah, like, maybe Wolverine was my favorite, like, character when I was a kid, but, like, what does it really matter? It doesn't really matter. But anyway, yeah, so, shit, Dunkirk, so...
Mm-hmm.
I definitely need to see it.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if you like it. I don't think it's for everybody. There's just something really, I don't know, beautiful and tragic in that movie. So what's your number six?
My number six?
Oh, wait, no, oh, seven, wait, no. Seven. Sorry.
Seven. oh, shit. I lost my place. So number seven, okay. Number seven.
I'm really interested to see if we have like a match on a certain number.
We might. There might. I'm sure there might be some crossover. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet. But my number seven is The Survivalist.
Oh, me too.
Really?
Yeah.
Sick. All right, twinsies then.
That's a good one.
Oh, it's great.
It's a fucking existential dread, man.
Yeah, and it leaves you with a lot of questions and a lot of, which I like, and that's it's perfect in that way. It's just like you get to the end, yeah, and you don't know.
Right, you had a very interesting theory on what the end is.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, and maybe we'll cover it, but yeah, the end just leaves you kind of like, holy shit, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
But not in a way where you're unsatisfied and you're like,
oh, right,
fuck that movie.
No.
Which I bet you anything. Like I said, passive viewers will see the ending and go straight to their computer and be
right. What does the ending of
what
The Survivalist
fuck,
mean?
Fuck this fucking bullshit movie.
Or that, yeah.
That doesn't, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
if it doesn't end perfect for people, they like, they fucking hate any movie
I'm kind of
that doesn't end perfectly.
I'm kind of one of those.
You are?
Yeah. But with The Survivalist, you know, I mean, they could definitely make, like, they could make another film on the ending alone. You know, it's just so heavy in what it could mean, you know. And I'm glad that they didn't. I'm glad that they haven't. I hope they don't. Because this movie is, I think, it's perfect. It's a perfect film. There's nothing about it I would change.
Yeah, I think it is perfect. Very stark kind of realism, but it's also this, like, dystopian kind of dread.
Really good. It yeah, just makes
very
you
very brutal.
It just makes you think about, you know, any about post-apocalyptic scenarios and, like, you know, how far can you push yourself to survive?
Yeah, and I think actually the reason that I was able to watch this, or the reason that got me interested in it, is actually because of another film that's on my list later on.
Oh, all right.
That's kind of similar in theme. So what is your sixth skill?
It Comes at Night.
Oh, It Comes at Night.
Yeah.
So sad to see that so far down on your list.
So I'm guessing it's pretty high on your list.
Well.
Yeah, no, It's really good. I know some people that didn't like it or just didn't quite fulfill what they thought it would be. But for me, as a dad, that's why this film was so heavy for me, because well, can't really say much more, but as a parent, that's a hard film to watch.
Yeah. And it's just so, like, the way that they did it is so unorthodox. I mean, not that you're going to find something too radically different than like, sort of other dystopian tales. But it's just, Trey Edward Schultz just has this power of just doing these really weird things in his films, like sort of flashing images, you know, on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of like playing with your sort of dread. And like, I felt that it had this sort of masterful tension building in it, to where the entire film you're kind of tense and just kind of like waiting for the build up, and everything is building up, and the story is just getting darker and darker and more brutal and just like descending and descending.
Just like Krisha.
Yeah, just like Krisha.
It just like...
Which was his first... I think it was his first... I think it was a directorial debut.
It was.
But, dude, he created this horror, this sort of, like, I'm not going to call it horror, but in a sense it is horror.
Because
mm-hmm. there's all this dread and stuff, and it's like, it's about a fucking old lady going to Thanksgiving. I mean, you could really put it in those terms.
It's so funny.
And it's like... It has like slasher flick elements where it plays these weird little sounds, and it kind of like these cool shots, you know, like where a character's looking at a character and you kind of feel this sort of kind of like the emotion that the person is feeling. Like, you know, Krisha's like looking at her son, and the kind of like camera follows him.
Right.
And then like it stops on his face, and he's kind of like maybe lying down, and she's upstairs.
It's uncomfortable, really uncomfortable.
And her face turns to him, or like she's looking at him, his face starts turning to her, and then by the time like their eyes align, like the shot cuts, and it's like just brilliant, fucking insanely brilliant things like that, like just mm-hmm. that give you this feeling of raw emotion.
He has this way of encapsulating these mental images that we all have had, we just never really think about it, and then you watch his films and you're like, oh man, I thought about that. I've lived that.
Right. I mean, Krisha in particular just seems like it was cut right from anybody's life. It could really literally be
anybody. Yeah.
Everybody has like some, you know, family member. Maybe they have like, they drink too much or something like that.
You don't want them to come around.
I guess I'm the Krisha. Nah, I'm just kidding. I'm not really like that.
But family needs a follow.
Yeah.
If any of you have watched About Time.
A what?
A faller?
I already forgot.
That's right. That's right.
That's pretty specific.
Oh, yeah. It'll hit you sometime. But yeah, It Comes at Night. What's also really interesting is you don't really know what it is. You know, what is it? You just know that it's certain death. But specifically... You know, if it's a virus, you just, I don't know. It's a really interesting mystery, and I'm glad that they don't bring to light what it is, how it started, none of that.
Yeah, and this is actually the film that I was referencing when I was talking about The Survivalist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very similar in theme, but also... Like I said, people are going to look at the ending of It Comes at Night, and they're going to sit... I've already seen it online. It's like, bullshit.
Right.
The fucking ending, it sucks. And it's like, it couldn't have been more perfect for me. I mean, like, it does what it needs to do. It tells you the whole fucking story. It's not some, like, David Lynch weird fucking thing that's going on, like, surreal art film type shit. It's very standard, but it's just, I'm sure everyone's seen it, so I'll, you know, no spoiler, but... It's abrupt, and people seem to not be able to handle that or understand it. And I thought it was perfect. And sometimes I personally might be bothered by an abrupt ending, but in this film, it was completely appropriate and it worked.
Yeah, it was like a punch in the throat. You know, you just have these two people sitting across from each other and not knowing where life goes from here. Is it even worth living?
Yeah, and it was actually inspired by his dad, like on his deathbed.
Fuck.
That
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember the exact line, but it's something about regretting, you know, like, because I guess he said those words to his dad on his dad's deathbed about regretting life or something like that. And that's kind of how the movie opens, you know what I mean? And so it's very, like, he wrote this very dismal, dark, like, deep, you know, introspective kind of thing about his life, but he kind of formed it in this dystopian kind of story.
Wow.
So I think it deserves to be a little higher on your list.
This guy's brilliant.
Yeah, he is brilliant.
I can't wait to see what he does next.
Yeah, me too.
We're in the top five.
Oh,
now.
Actually, you know what? So I think you just did your number six, right?
Yep.
Okay, so I'll do my number six.
Oh yeah.
Get ready for this, Gil. Thelma.
Great shit.
I just watched that last night.
You know, well, go ahead. Well, actually, yeah, it's almost my number five, so.
Oh, it is your number five?
Yeah.
Well, we might as well just joint it. We'll put it together, kind of, and then we'll just move into right. Number five after this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Thelma. One of the things that I was thinking is, like, it kind of plays with you because you kind of think that it's going to go into this. I don't really want to spoil it, but
dude, so there's actually, so
maybe I shouldn't spoil it, but I'll just say it was not what I was expecting because I was expecting a little bit more in, if you know what being a fatal film means, like,
oh yeah,
I kind
man.
Of expected it to be like to go into a different level, which it sort of did, but it sort of didn't. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't go all the way. Like, I kind of thought it was going to go all the way and kind of... But that's... I mean, that's kind of what I'm looking for in films right now. It's just all this, like, deep...
Right. Like,
mythology and stuff like that. But
a film
it did...
that's fatal to the flesh.
It was definitely a fatal film. Definitely fatal. I had never seen anything like that.
Right.
It's definitely a new story.
Right. Certainly.
One thing I was disappointed though, I was like, kind of, maybe 3/4 of the way down of the film, and I was like, they haven't had a character have a nosebleed yet, and I'm like, that's perfect. If we get to the end of this film, and this person that's having psychic things going on in her head doesn't have a nosebleed, then I'm calling this the greatest film of all time.
Oh man, why were you
eventually
anticipating a nosebleed?
Because every fucking movie where there's something going on with someone's head psychically or whatever, their nose bleeds. It's fucking stock. It's like, if I ever make a movie that has any sort of telekinesis or psychic things going on,
right?
They're not having a fucking nosebleed.
This
all right?
is all because of Stranger Things, right?
Well, no, it's everything. Think of a movie that has a character that has like psychic abilities or has psychic something going on.
What about X-Men?
I'm sure there's a nosebleed there.
Okay. Now, yeah. Well, Thelma is a Norwegian film, so I think that might automatically put off like half of the crowd because a lot of people don't like to read.
Subtitles.
Yeah. But there's so much to unpack in Thelma. I don't even comprehend it all. I mean, this is going to take like a good 3 watches to, I don't know, man, make it maybe 3/4 through of understanding the concept of this film and the story that it's trying to encapsulate. But, I mean, I don't even understand the overall meaning of the film. I don't get, there's just so much left
to understand. I'm still trying to work it out a little.
And once it's worked out, I think it'll probably be covered down the line because as far as films fatal to the flesh, man,
Definitely a fatal film.
It's fucking thick.
Because there's a lot of stuff going on in there that we kind of like.
Yeah.
And, man, like, I'll tell you too because I have a problem. I do have a hard time with, like, foreign films. I'm kind of slowly with this whole, watching Shudder and kind of watching Dark, like... I'm slowly, you know, gaining a little bit more of appreciation for, like, foreign films.
Yeah.
Which I know a lot of, like, I mean, for cinephiles, that's, dude, on all the cinephile snob groups that I'm on, like, all they like is just old fucking Japanese films and shit like that. And I'm like, But anyway, like, it didn't make me, like, enjoy the film any less whatsoever that it was, like, subtitled or that I didn't connect with these characters. I definitely did. And just the uniqueness of this story is, like, fucking... It's never been done before, definitely.
No.
It's never been done before.
No, it's never been done before, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it blew my mind when I really kind of figured out what was going on.
I just wonder, you know, a filmmaker like this, I mean, where this concept comes from.
Yeah.
But it's a brilliant, brilliant film.
It is brilliant.
All right, so number five.
Okay, so my number five is It by Andres Muschietti. It. What a great film, I think.
Yeah, it is. It was on my list, but I took it off.
You took it off? Why?
Because mm-hmm. I watched Thelma.
And that knocked it off somehow?
Mm-hmm.
But shouldn't it be, like, somewhere?
I had it at number 10, and then I watched Thelma, and I had to put Thelma in, and it got bumped off. But, yeah, it's excellent. It really is.
Okay, so a little background. When I was around 7 or 8, they would play It every winter or every Halloween or something like that. It came on TV. It was the miniseries.
Right.
And they would play it every year or whatever. And all the kids at school would be like, oh, did you see it? Did you see it? So everyone would have to see it, because if you didn't, then you were like a coward or something. But it left me traumatized every fucking year. And like, I would see this clown in my dreams, and it was scary as fuck, and it was the scariest thing that I could possibly imagine. And this was actually really very close to the book in terms of, like, it was kind of like a play-by-play from the book.
Huh.
I mean, there were things that it left out, and I've only read half the book. It's fucking huge.
Right.
But it was very much closer to the book than I had expected it to be. And the thing is like, what really pisses me off is that people... I think this is, like, one of the most successful horror films. I think it was, like, wasn't it, like, the most successful rated R horror film or some shit like that?
Yeah, yeah.
So everyone I knew saw it. Everyone that I worked with saw it. Pretty much everyone in the world saw it. The general consensus, though, pissed me off. It seemed to be that they thought it was some sort of jokey, funny movie.
Hmm.
Just because the characters joked around and stuff like that. And... because the It monster, like, I thought the It monster was fucking terrifying, and it looked terrifying, but I can see how people were like, oh, it has, like, goofy eyes, or it did something weird, or it danced. But they all, and I think it is one of those things, like, they were uncomfortable, they didn't want to be scared, so they would just, like, make fun of it.
Yeah, people who have a fear of clowns, automatically, probably.
But I loved how, because what I was hoping... When I thought about it, when I heard it was being remade, I was like, I hope they do the whole giant rows of teeth that the It has and all this stuff. And they did that. They like did. Actually,
yeah.
And like the gigantic It and that type of stuff, like
in the garage.
Yeah, they did.
Oh man,
yeah,
that was fucking freaky.
Yeah, man, when the big It's just like coming at them and stuff. But yeah, man, like I thought it was extremely effective. It is a very complex story, so it was a lot to put into that, you know, I don't know, a couple hours or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long it was exactly, but I know it was longer than a normal horror film. But I think it was very well done and very close to the Stephen King book.
Yeah, and it was a really good, I think, well, they definitely surpassed the TV series.
Yeah.
And it's very rare that anyone can pull off a Stephen King story.
Yeah.
And they did it perfect.
Oh, yeah, they did. All right, so what's your number four?
Number four would have to be Mother.
Number four?
Yeah.
That's like your favorite film of all time.
Darren Aronofsky. So here's the thing, man. When we watched Mother, it blew me away. Totally blew my mind. And I considered it probably to be my favorite movie of all time when I first watched it. It was just so good. Of course, the whole biblical concept was fascinating to me. And I think they did it really well. I think he did really well in creating this biblical narrative in a modern sense. But then I rewatched The Fountain. And if you don't know, The Fountain was done by Aronofsky also. And seeing what he was able to pull off with The Fountain made me feel like he could have done better with Mother.
So this is interesting because I'll give you some background. We actually went to see this, me, you, and your lovely wife, Fallon. We went out to the movie theater and we saw this together. Had I not been with you, I probably would have left.
Right.
Maybe 20, 30 minutes in. As soon as it started feeling like a sort of stage play, I probably would have just got up and walked out.
Yeah, well, we walked out and I was like, what'd you think? And you were like, I fucking hated it.
Yeah, my initial reaction was complete disgust because it's a very difficult film to watch. And what I think happened is all these people that kind of fancy themselves as like cinephiles watched it and kind of thought that they should like it. Rather than they actually liked it, you know?
Yeah.
And I actually have a much deeper appreciation for it, not only from listening to the IndieWire Filmmakers Toolkit episode about it, which, again, that fucking series is probably my favorite film podcast
really
series.
Good.
It's phenomenal. I mean, they just get these great directors and just kind of pick their brains. And it's very short. It's only like 20 minutes or something.
Right.
It's not but he long goes enough. Over sort of the tedious process of like what he went to make this perfect film. And I think he achieved an insane masterpiece, honestly, with this film, in ways that I probably don't even understand right now. And we could probably watch it 100 times and we might, it's one of those films, you know?
Yeah. And the hardest part about this film for everyone is the third act, because it gets, I can't even explain it. But it's intense. And there's a lot of concepts, a lot of themes that are really dramatic and really, they push you back. You don't really quite understand how to take them. But I don't know. Like I said, after watching The Fountain, because the themes are similar, you know, and The Fountain is just, it's beautiful and it's perfect. And I just think that with that kind of filmmaking, I think Mother could have gone a little bit further. Or maybe he didn't need to do such a... I think that third act was maybe too much.
Here's what I think it is. These are two different stories. You're going to have two different outcomes. It's going to be two different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, to compare the two in terms of what he could have did or what he should have did, I don't think that's fair, because I think like Mother and The Fountain are two extremely different things. You know what I mean? And so I think he achieved what he set out to achieve with Mother.
Yeah, there's a lot there. It's a great film. Don't get me wrong. And maybe I'm wrong in comparing the two.
I never thought we'd be across the table and I would be the one that was like, Mother's better than what you think Mother is, that type of thing. But yeah, man, like, I hated it. It was a terrible experience for me to watch it. But now, after I've seen it, it's kind of one of those movies, like, after you see it and you kind of research it and study it a little bit, it kind of reveals how, like, what a masterpiece it is. Kind of what it was going for and that type of thing.
Yeah. No, I agree. And again, it's just with the whole... So the concepts in Mother, when I first watched it, I understood them, you know, and so I kept trying to unwrap it as much as I could and try to figure out a way that it could have been done better, because there were certain things that were real rash. But at the same time, when I did that, I realized that things within Mother that you didn't quite care for, they couldn't have... They couldn't have spoken to the biblical narrative in any other way.
Right.
So, I mean, I try to conceptualize on how I think they could have brought out certain parts in scripture better, but I guess I don't think that it was possible. I think they did it the best way that they could.
And what I found to be the most painful aspect of the film, which is the sort of uncomfortable chaos, and it's just like sort of, I don't know, 20 or 30 minutes of people destroying a house and running through a house, and just like the house being more and more destroyed, and like, which, you know, that's the representation of the Mother Earth and that type of thing.
Right.
But like, I kind of relate that to sort of why I like the more murky, crazy, like chaotic sort of music, sort of anti-music, because I do like that idea of like this chaos and shit, and like just this, it's brutal. It's very black metal. You know what I mean?
Right.
It has a very black metal ethos.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you guys knew this, but we are a black metal podcast.
Yeah.
That's what we've decided this is. Yeah, we're doing things a little different here. We're doing things a little more brutal.
More orthodox.
And hardcore. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Where are we? Number four?
You're number four.
My number four.
Yeah.
Get ready for this, Gil. It's A Ghost Story by David Lowery. And, you know, it could be any of these of my four through one could... I mean, okay, like one is solid, but four through two, these could all be interchangeable, you know?
It's kind of how I felt.
I loved fucking Ghost Story so much. It's so, you know... I hate to keep repeating myself, but it's definitely a very unorthodox. You've never seen this kind of film before. They really touched new ground with what they did. And they went for a very minimalist kind of feeling, which is incredible. I mean, with the ghosts with the sheets over them. That's the representation of the ghost characters. And, I mean, that's fucking cool as fuck.
Yeah, well, on the Filmmakers Toolkit podcast episode on A Ghost Story is also...
Right. Great. Yeah, and they explain how like the actual ghost in a sheet is like much more difficult to like work with than right. If you were to like, you know, make this crazy monster or some shit, you know, because that's all built and shit.
Right.
With the ghosts, they had to decide like where's the shadow hitting,
exactly.
You know, what's the, you know.
And it was that whole thing of like, you know, they had to remove Casey Affleck's
personality,
stature, and personality,
yeah.
Because it was too much. And
so
they had to pull it back.
They had to have him like in a kind of a monotone
right.
Kind of expression of himself.
He's definitely the better Affleck.
You think?
Fucking A.
Yeah, actually, I'll give it to him.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
I love Casey Affleck.
So do I. Wow. I think he's great. Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, Manchester.
Ooh, buddy.
Damn, that's a fucking great film.
Yeah, really tugs at the heart.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, A Ghost Story is phenomenal. Just the whole idea of the eternity of time and what is time? What is it?
Yeah, and it's such a bleak, like, terrible, like, it leaves you with this existential dread because it's like, fuck, man, your eternity is just this, you're standing in this place and then watching time go by forever and ever. It's like, as a human being, you can't, like, I mean, that sounds like torment.
Yeah, and... Well, without giving too much away, there was a moment where you feel like Casey Affleck's character could have transitioned to the other side, we'll say. And for whatever reason, he chose not to, whether it was confusion or there was something more that he needed to realize. But
yes.
I love how they play with time in this film. It's really romantic.
Yeah, it blows the mind.
Mm-hmm. Which... I mean, in that, A Ghost Story is my number three.
Oh, it's your number three?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal film.
Do you think Casey Affleck didn't sing that part?
From my understanding, no.
They didn't just use his voice and then quantize it or something?
I don't believe so.
Are you sure? Because it sounds like exactly like his voice.
We don't have a Jamie.
Oh, I know. Shit.
But yeah, well, Fallon looked it up, and she looked up the song, and the song was by artist of whatever name.
Well, it could have been written by them.
Could have been. I don't know. I didn't look into it myself.
Ah, that's a mystery. We're going to have to pick it back up once we cover it.
Right? But yeah, it's a beautiful film. It's
I think it's fatal.
Nothing
like it.
Would you
say it's fatal?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah, it's definitely fatal. Absolutely. So we'll definitely cover it at some point.
Yeah.
So look forward to that. Fuck, man. What a great film. I love it.
So do I. Love is, yeah, it's perfect.
Fuck yeah.
So you're number three.
I thought
A Ghost Story was my number three.
Oh, A Ghost Story was your number three. Mm-hmm. So I guess we've already passed that. Actually, Mother's my number three, so we've already passed that. It Comes Ooh. At Night is my number two.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
All right.
Number two. What is your number two?
Woodshock.
Woodshock is your number Woodshock fucking is my two? Number two.
And fuck all of you people who think that Woodshock sucks. If you think Woodshock sucks, you're not paying attention.
Now, just to give a little information, Woodshock got a really extremely low.
Extremely low.
Like in the 10 to 18 range.
It was 18% when I watched it, and I checked it today, and it's bumped up to 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. But
well, here's the thing. I've actually seen it get some good, from the common people, you know?
Yeah.
I've actually seen it get some good review, I guess you would say.
Well, I think that the fundamental story within Woodshock is something that every single person living experiences, which is why I think the film is so beautiful and so powerful, because this subject matter, how do you approach it? And we can say that Kirsten Dunst approached it wrong or right. It's kind of hard to tell, you know, but death is of the most terrible things, and to maintain its works requires the greatest of strengths. And that's what this film is and why it's so beautiful. So cannabis plays a big part in the film. So you kind of have to green light yourself when you watch this film. And when you
and
do,
that's what I hear.
When
from
you
every...
do, man, it takes you into this other world. And I don't know if it was just my experience or if everyone who watches this film greenlit will have the same experience. But for me, the way the film transitions and the visuals that it puts on screen had this ebb and flow, because when I get greenlit, it ebbs and flows, you know, it comes in waves where, you know, you're fine and then it hits you really hard and then you're fine and it comes back. And that's kind of how this film plays out. It so happened that whenever these really intense visuals struck the screen was when the flow was at its heaviest. So you are experiencing this film in so many different ways. And I think that, so if you watch this film under the right influences, I think you can understand its beauty.
Yeah, I actually started watching it a little bit, and then the first part of it's super sad, and then I was well, I think I'm gonna have to save this for another night.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to be in the right frame of mind to take on a sad story. But I guess it turns into something else. I'm imagining, right?
Well, we'll leave that unsaid.
Well, I mean, so you can't say whether or not it's it remains completely depressing throughout, or you get through this depressing part and then some other shit happens. What can you say?
Guess
or can you say it?
Depends on your outlook on death.
Oh, well. Dismal.
Well, there you go.
We'll just say, we'll call it dismal.
Right.
How about that? So what does that leave us on? We're on two?
Well, you said your two is...
Your two is Woodshock. Holy fucking shit. I guess I have to see it then.
Mm-hmm.
That's strong.
I was blown away. And Fallon didn't like it. Or, well, I don't want to say she didn't like it. She didn't like it as much as I did. So I don't think it's for everybody. And she has a remarkable taste on films. So I don't know.
Why do you think, in your opinion, that they gave it such a low rating? Why would a critic... Think through the mind of the critic. What would you think is the reason why they would give it such a low rating.
Because they didn't elevate themselves to the ether.
Yeah?
Yeah. I really do think that that is a very important aspect of the film. Whether they intended it to be that way or not.
Oh, I think they did. And I think it was extremely effective, their campaign to make this sort of a, hey, watch this while you're high movie.
And there's a really strong link between the concept that you find in Mother and the concepts that you find in the feminine archetype.
Right.
And they did it really well.
Wow.
So I guess we all know what number one is.
Ah, I think cheers. So. Cheers.
Good time.
It's a good time. We didn't know. I mean, we had an idea, but we didn't know that Good Time was going to be. Well, we did know. But let's pretend that we didn't.
Okay.
For the sake of the show.
Yeah, and I kind of fucked up because when you said that we should do this, I was like, oh, I think we're going to have the same number one.
Yeah, and then you wrote Mother. And I was like, oh, fuck, I know you're going to choose Good Time.
How could you not? It's a perfect film from beginning to end. It hits every emotional level. It's hard for me to conceptualize a film that comes close to what Good Time is. It's another one of those films that has never been done before. This storyline has never been done before. These characters have never been done before. I mean, Robert Pattinson's performance is inspiring.
Yeah, and one thing that I was thinking about is, like, if you just put this down on paper and you were just looking at it, reading the dialogue. So let's say from the time, like, the action happens in the middle and you're on this sort of action train. If you were to actually just write down the dialogue of the characters and look at it, you'd probably be like, oh, well, this isn't really anything. But once you combine the aesthetics of the music, the lighting, the acting, the just brilliant fucking storytelling, like, once you combine all of those elements, it becomes something that transcends, like, fucking what a great film is, man. And there, you know, it is getting good reviews and it is getting sort of, like, passed on, but really, man, like, I just really can't see somebody that loves film watching this and not being absolutely fucking blown away by the impact of the storytelling, the just the visceral feeling that what it gives you, you know.
It's definitely the best film of the year. I don't understand how it could
be. It definitely is, and I don't understand how anybody could not see it as that.
Fucking politics.
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see people looking at this as some sort of just, oh, it's just an exploitation crime film. But they miss the beginning and the end and that type of thing.
They miss the point if that's the result they came out with.
And what they were saying is they wanted to use unknown characters or unknown actors. And then, well, you know, it's like the director himself or one of the directors.
Right.
And one of the mysteries is I don't know who the dude that they break out of the hospital is.
Like, as far as an actor?
Like, I tried to look it up on IMDb. I couldn't find a picture of the guy. Like, there was no information about it.
That guy's great.
So, could it be, like, one of them dressed up, like, as a character? Or, like...
Oh, interesting.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I couldn't find any information about it online. Like...
Because that guy was amazing. I mean, his performance was amazing, you know? So it's
The bro dude.
Where is he in other films, and why isn't he in other films?
Yeah.
Just phenomenal. I mean, the moment that he opens his mouth, you're just like, he got you. He has you, you know? Right. I mean, he's just so strong in his performance. I mean, that whole acid scene, I don't want to give anything away, but I think anybody who has dipped their toe into psychedelics during that acid scene, you're just like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. You really feel the characters.
Poor, poor, poor dude.
Yeah, it gets fucked over. Oh, but yeah, man, like, just the perpetual motion of this film and, like, sort of, you know, like I was saying, they wanted the impact of seeing characters on screen that you'd never seen before. And the thing is, you see Robert Pattinson, but you don't recognize him.
You don't recognize him.
You wouldn't be able to recognize him right off the bat.
And he's English, and you would never know that he's English if you didn't know who he was. I mean,
he is English?
Straight up fucking New York is how he pulls it off in this film. But yeah, he's English.
Yeah, it's so brilliant, and there's just all these brilliant lines and stuff throughout the film. You know, like, I think I was a dog in a previous life. Like, that's why they love me so much.
Right.
You know, just little... And intersplicing with sort of news reports and stuff on the television and stuff that kind of pushes the narrative along. It's, like, also brilliant. You know, like... And you see his character, and you sort of sympathize with him throughout the film, but the whole story is telling you in the background that he's a fucking complete scumbag.
Exactly.
The entire way.
This dude is poison.
He's like the worst. Fucking
poison.
And he's the reason why, like, all the bad in the film is happening. And he's the reason why his brother, his disabled brother, is going through so much suffering is because of him. And, like, the whole plot is him trying to fix what he's done. But he's not, he doesn't realize that he's the fucking reason why all this shit's happening.
Yeah, it's that whole thing, it's in Notes of the Underground by Dostoevsky, where there's a character that's like that, you know, like, realizes at a certain point that he has really fucked up and is trying to make things right. But he doesn't make things right personally. He doesn't fix himself personally. So he's trying to help these people, but ends up leaving them worse off than they were when they met him. And that's Pattinson's character.
Oh, he's so fucking good in this one, man. Like, just watch Good Time. There's not much more I can say. Watch the fucking film. It's just, it will, if you watch it and you actually pay attention from beginning to end.
How could you not?
Turn off all the lights. Turn the fucking shit way up. Turn your stereo way the fuck up. Put it on. You're going to be blown away. And that's a triple F guarantee.
Yeah, I would. There's very few films where I almost feel like begging people to watch it. And that's Good Time. I beg people to watch this film.
It caused me to yell. It caused me to cry a lot at the end. And I was like, what in the fuck just happened to me? And that should happen with, you know, that should be the impact of film, you know?
It leaves you speechless.
That's what makes a great film. It's just you emotionally reacting to something.
Right.
Deeply. Cool. And with that, that seals our top 10 of 2017 films fatal to the flesh.
That's right.
Right?
Cheers.
Hell yeah. Cheers, guys. Rate and review on iTunes if you can. Follow us on social media, please. And stay fatal, folks. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
Unconscious chicken.